This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the UN Children's Fund says the explosion of digital technology and growing internet access holds both benefits and risks for children. UNICEF's annual State of the World's Children report explores ways to protect children from the potential harm of the expanding digital world.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. We'll have full details on the story coming up.
Also, New York police say a suspect is in custody after an explosion near the city's bus terminal this morning. And the UN is urgently appealing today for countries to take in 1,300 extremely vulnerable refugees stranded in Libya.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the UN Children's Fund says the explosion of digital technology and growing internet access holds both benefits and risks for children. UNICEF's annual State of the World's Children report explores ways to protect children from the potential harm of the expanding digital world. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund reports one in three internet users around the world is a child. Despite this huge and growing online presence, UNICEF says little is known about the impact of digital technology on children's well-being, and little is being done to protect them from the perils of the digital world. UNICEF Director of Data Research and Policy, Lawrence Chandy, tells VOA, the internet can be a game changer for children.
We sincerely believe that especially for kids in places where opportunities are few or for children who are disabled, live in remote places, it's completely intuitive that the internet has enormous potential and is already helping children access opportunity that just wasn't conceivable not long ago.
At the same time, he says the internet poses many risks. These include the misuse of children's private information, access to harmful content, and cyberbullying. Chandy says criminal digital networks make children vulnerable to some of the worst forms of exploitation and abuse, including trafficking and online child sexual abuse. He says safeguarding children's privacy on the internet is an issue of major concern.
We're really emphasizing the importance of putting in place safeguards to prevent children's personal data from falling in wrong people's hands and protecting their identities. This is an issue which is only going to grow in importance.
While the risks are great, Chandy criticizes businesses and regulators for doing little to reduce the dangers. The report finds millions of children are still missing out on the benefits offered by the internet. It notes around one-third of the world's youth, most in developing countries, are not online. It calls for these inequities to be addressed. It says children everywhere must be given the opportunity to participate in an increasingly digital economy. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
France has ordered a major international recall of several baby formula milk and baby food products made by French dairy giant Lactalis after the detection of Salmonella bacteria in some items. The French Ministry of the Economy ordered the suspension of marketing and export of several infant nutrition products manufactured since February 15, 2017 at the Lactalis factory in Craon. The French Consumer Protection Agency said that Lactalis has not managed the contamination risk since 26 cases of the illnesses were first reported. The recall includes products for export to markets in Africa, Asia, Europe, and Latin America.
Here in the U.S., New York police say a suspect is in custody after an explosion near the Port Authority bus terminal today that Mayor Bill de Blasio called an attempted terrorist attack. New York Police Commissioner James O'Neill identified the suspect as 27-year-old Akayed Ula and said he had an improvised low-tech explosive device attached to his body. Ula has sustained burns and wounds to his body after intentionally detonating the device, confirmed as a pipe bomb, O'Neill told reporters, speaking alongside Mayor de Blasio and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo this morning. The New York Fire Department confirmed three other injuries, all non-life-threatening.
The UN urgently appealed today for countries to take in 1,300 extremely vulnerable refugees stranded in Libya following revelations of horrific abuse of migrants in the country. The UN Refugee Agency said there was a dire need for 1,300 resettlement places by the end of March 2018. Libya has long been a major transit hub for migrants trying to reach Europe. Many refugees and migrants have fallen prey to serious abuse there at the hands of human traffickers and others.
A Zimbabwean media studies specialist in South Africa says he won't be leaving for his homeland anytime soon. Dr. Shepherd Mpofu at the University of Johannesburg says he remains deeply scarred by events that happened under the rule of Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Shepherd Mpofu grew up in rural Gwanda district in Matabeleland South. He has fond memories of hunting rabbits and herding cattle. He says his relatives were poor farmers, but they were happy until the Zimbabwe Army's notorious 5th Brigade began visiting them in 1983 to persecute anyone perceived to be against President Robert Mugabe. Mpofu was 5 years old.
Our uncles were a bit older than us. We'd be given sticks to beat up our grannies and our grandfathers, you know. That kind of beating where young boys would be asked to beat even their parents, their aunties and their uncles. Small boys were made to watch those kinds of things.
Mpofu says he became aggressive because of the trauma and only learned to deal with his anger and fear later in life. He says the Mugabe government's Gukurahundi operation against the Ndebele people was genocide, with thousands murdered within 2 years.
Some of the people in the village disappeared. Even up to now, they are not known where they are.
Mpofu says because of what happened to his people, ZANU-PF can't be trusted, no matter who's in charge of it. As a student in Bulawayo in 2004, Mpofu started a newspaper to cover underdevelopment in Matabeleland. Soon after, he says, the harassment began.
You'd receive calls in the middle of the night from a hidden number. Once you answer hello, and the next question is, where are you? Sometimes you say, I'm home, and then the person cuts, and then you panic, like, what have I done? Who have I told that I'm at home?
Mpofu often had to go into hiding. The government soon shut the newspaper down. Mpofu moved to South Africa in 2006 to study. He returned to Bulawayo in 2008.
When I went back, there was only matches being sold and sold. There was no electricity, no water. It was really depressing. People were sleeping in bank queues. It was terrible. I just bought a ticket back to South Africa and I couldn't.
Mpofu says this experience cured his homesickness. Since then, he's remained in South Africa, only visiting Zimbabwe briefly in 2014.
One comfort that I got was that at least there was food in the shops. I could see there was a high number of ex-Japanese cars on the roads, which suggested that to a certain extent some people are doing well to afford to buy fuel and to afford to buy those kinds of cars.
Mpofu is married to a South African engineer, and they have a 1-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old son. He says when they're older, he'll make sure Zimbabwe is part of them.
Zimbabwe is my home of birth. They have to connect with the people in back in Zimbabwe. But they have to know that it's a place that gave me terrible experiences. It's a place that gave their forefathers terrible experiences.
Mpofu isn't convinced that the new government will spark much positive change in Zimbabwe. He's also not surprised President Emmerson Mnangagwa's administration won't prosecute Mugabe.
He's being granted immunity. by the same people who are responsible for the genocide in Matabeleland. It's actually painful. We're waiting for a time where we would be in a position to actually take Mugabe to court. This will have a ripple effect because it will implicate even the current president, Mnangagwa.
Mpofu says the new president's words, "let bygones be bygones," at his inauguration, are still ringing in his ears.
You cannot wish genocide away and say, "let's forget, let bygones be bygones, let's move ahead."
Mpofu says he'll begin to believe in a new Zimbabwe when Mnangagwa allows the release of two reports on the killings in Matabeleland that remain secret. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. According to a UN report, the explosion of digital technology and growing internet access holds both benefits and risks for children. New York police say a suspect is in custody after an explosion near the city's bus terminal this morning. And the UN is urgently appealing today for countries to take in 1,300 extremely vulnerable refugees stranded in Libya. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Two recent studies report successes for highly promising genetic strategies against malaria. Researchers at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health's Malaria Research Institute say one of the strategies used a genetic modification to the mosquito to suppress malaria parasites. And to the researchers' surprise, the effects spread quickly in a test population because this genetic modification also changed the mosquito's mating preferences. The studies were published in the journal Science. George Demopoulos is a professor with the Johns Hopkins Malaria Research Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. He is also a lead researcher on the study. He spoke with me about the findings.
My laboratory has been studying the mosquito's innate immune system for many years, and we have been interested in understanding how mosquitoes can fight infections with pathogens such as malaria. And we discovered certain genes in the mosquito that were involved in this fight against the malaria parasite, and that when you would activate this immune system through those genes, the mosquitoes would become more resistant to infection. So after that discovery, we decided to look into the possibility of genetically modifying mosquitoes that would have a stronger immune system and thereby be better at fighting the parasite. We created several genetically modified mosquito strains that would turn on this anti-malarial immune system in their gut tissue and in other tissues after a blood meal. So mosquitoes, they feed on blood in order to produce eggs. Through that blood, they acquire the malaria parasite. So when they would ingest the malaria parasite with the blood, these transgenic mosquitoes, they would turn on their immune system, so they would be better at fighting off infection. And indeed, these mosquitoes proved to be more resistant to infection with a malaria parasite. We thought perhaps this could one day evolve into a malaria control strategy.
When you were describing the actual modification, so you were talking about actually modifying the DNA of the mosquito?
Yes, that's correct. So one unique aspect of this approach we took to modify the mosquito genetically was that we don't introduce a foreign gene into the mosquito. So this mosquito does not have anything foreign. We didn't really change its DNA in a profound way. The only thing we did was to change the timing by which a certain gene in the mosquito was turned on. So genes are turned on and off depending on when they're needed in the DNA. So we just changed a fairly small element in the DNA to make a gene turn on after the mosquito feeds on blood. its own gene, not a foreign gene. So although these mosquitoes are genetically modified, the genetic modification could be considered to be quite subtle.
In terms of trying to control the spread of malaria, say, for example, in Africa, where it is very prevalent there, so would these mosquitoes be released in African countries?
Well, not these mosquitoes that we have developed, but perhaps mosquitoes that have been similarly genetically modified. We're still working on optimizing this approach. Before any releases could happen, we would have to perform a series of semi-field and laboratory testing of these mosquitoes for a variety of parameters to make sure that the application would be safe, although I cannot think of anything that would go terribly wrong with this approach. And we would obviously also have to obtain approval from various authorities and entities for this kind of approach. So this is not something that's going to happen in the next year or not even perhaps in the next 5 years. It's going to take a while until we get this to work. However, because this strategy of releasing malaria parasite-resistant mosquitoes has some profound advantages, we still think it's worth investing in it and working on this, because if you can get this to work, you could end up having a malaria control strategy that is logistically not very complex, and it could be a self-propagating malaria control strategy, meaning you could release a certain number of mosquitoes and they would spread the resistance gene in the natural mosquito population and gradually convert mosquitoes to resistant for the malaria parasite and thereby not able to transmit the disease.
George Demopoulos is a professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health's Malaria Research Institute. He spoke with me from Baltimore, Maryland.
The World Health Organization reports rapid action has succeeded in bringing an outbreak of Marburg virus in Uganda under control and prevented the spread of this deadly disease just a matter of weeks after it was first detected. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The first case of this deadly disease in Uganda was confirmed on October 17th. Laboratory tests found the death of a 50-year-old woman was due to an infection caused by the Marburg virus. World Health Organization spokeswoman Fadela Shaib says her agency immediately got to work as soon as it was notified.
Within 24 hours of being informed by the Ugandan Health Authorities in early October, WHO deployed a rapid response team to the remote mountainous area, and we help finance the immediate support and scale up the response in Uganda and Kenya.
WHO released $623,000 from its emergency fund to finance this action. Marburg is a highly fatal disease caused by a virus from the same family as that of Ebola. It can be transmitted from person to person by bodily fluids and can cause bleeding, fever, vomiting, diarrhea, and other symptoms. Shaib tells VOA this was the fifth outbreak of Marburg virus in the past decade, so Uganda knows what to do when the disease strikes. But she says important lessons also have been learned from the West African Ebola epidemic that killed more than 11,000 people.
Marburg is very infectious. It was also important to trace all the contacts of this first case and to follow them for a period of 21 days, plus 21 days, just to make sure that there is no other cases being detected.
WHO reports three people died over the course of the outbreak, which affected two districts in eastern Uganda near the Kenyan border. The UN agency notes surveillance and contact tracing on the Kenyan side of the border by the Kenyan Ministry of Health and partners also prevented cross-border spread of the disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A rare painting by Albert Namatjira, one of Australia's most iconic Aboriginal artists, is to be sold to raise money for kidney patients in remote parts of Central Australia. Indigenous people suffer kidney disease at 15 times the national average. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Albert Namatjira was a trailblazer. Born in 1902 near Alice Springs in Australia's rugged Northern Territory, he didn't start painting seriously until he was 32 years old. His Western-inspired watercolours were a radical departure from traditional Indigenous art symbols and design, and he became a household name in Australia. The renowned Aboriginal artist was even featured on an Australian postage stamp in the late 1960s. His famous painting called Mount Hermannsburg is considered to be one of the most valuable examples of his work. It's been donated by an Aboriginal group to a renal centre in Alice Springs to raise money to help Indigenous patients receive treatment nearer to home rather than travel hundreds of kilometres. Sarah Brown, the head of the Purple House, the kidney unit that's been given the Namatjira painting, says it's an incredible gesture.
So I got a phone call saying, "Hey Sarah, Nurajuta borders met. We'd like you to come to the Araluen Art Centre and choose an Albert Namatjira painting." And I thought, I'm never going to have a phone call like that ever again. Central Australia is really the centre of the universe for kidney failure. There's well over 350 people in Central Australia who need dialysis, which is usually hemodialysis, which is 3 days a week, 5 hours a session.
Namatjira's Mount Hermannsburg painting is expected to fetch about $75,000 at auction. The painter died in 1959 at the age of 57. Australia's Aboriginal people are by far the country's most disadvantaged group, suffering high rates of ill health, poverty, imprisonment and unemployment. They make up about 3% of Australia's population of almost 25 million people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hello Africa, this is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5 and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.